Hello, fellow humans. Welcome to Beyond Words, a podcast exploring the rich space where language, music, cognition, and creativity converge. On this show, we dive into conversations that span the spectrum of human communication, from the way that music and language intersect to how sonic experience shapes our brains. I'm your host, Garrett Oyama, a practicing SLP, professional musician, and PhD student researcher at UCLA. This podcast is brought to you by SpeechTherapyPD.com, and many of the episodes are available for CEU credits through their website. So, what lies beyond the words we speak? Tune in and find out. On language, music, and mind in collaboration with SpeechTherapyPD.com. I'm your host, Garrett Oyama. I'm a musician, practicing speech therapist, and a PhD student with interest in all things language, music, and cognition. And I'm super excited today that we have the one and only Dr. Gibson. And Dr. Edward Gibson, aka Ted, is a professor of cognitive science in MIT's Department of Brain and Cognitive Sciences and the director of the MIT Language Lab. His research investigates how human languages are shaped by cognitive and communicative pressures, including memory constraints, ambiguity, and noise. And through large-scale corpus analyses across dozens of languages, he provides compelling evidence for dependency grammar and dependency length minimization, showing that languages universally favor shorter syntactic dependencies to ease processing. And he has a book coming out at the end of the year, Syntax, a Cognitive Approach, and really looking forward to that. Before we get started, just a few items to mention. Most of these podcasts, including today's, will have an accompanying course on Speech Therapy PD that is available for 0.1 ASHA CEUs. And just a couple of disclosures, we each get compensation from Speech Therapy PD, but there are no other relevant non-financial disclosures to report at this time. So without further ado, Dr. Gibson, welcome to Beyond Words.
Thank you for having me. Nice to be here.
Yeah, I always ask the guests just a little bit about their origin story, and you've done so many amazing things. And I was just wondering, what got you interested in this field of language?
That's a good question. So my background is, originally I was a math and computer science major. I was an undergrad in Canada. I'm Canadian. I'm from Toronto originally, and I went to a university called Queen's University in Kingston, and I did a double major in math and computer science. And in my last year, which was 1985, it's a long time ago now, 40 years, I took an artificial intelligence course, AI course in computer science. And in that class, there was a little section on natural language processing, human language. And I really liked the topic. I actually thought the way that the approach, the methods they were using seemed kind of obviously wrong. And so it's a long time ago, it's 80s, it's like 1980s, and they were way off. And so I thought, I liked language. And so I started, I actually applied to a program to do a master's in computational linguistics, after one part of that one class. And then once I did that, it was at Cambridge in the UK, and I enjoyed that master's program a lot. And there I read sort of basic literature in the master's program in sort of psychology of language and how language is produced and understood. And once again, I had the intuition that what people had done in the 80s up till then, sort of 60s, 70s, 80s, wasn't very compelling. And I thought the questions were really interesting. I found the questions of why certain kinds of materials like seem like they should follow the rules of English, for example, and yet they're so hard to produce or understand. And so it felt like, well, this is kind of a neat way to study illusions. Those illusions have been studied a lot in vision and how vision works. And this is kind of like a different cognitive process here. And I thought this would be a really fun avenue to explore, having read the literature. And then I just... You know, it's sort of weird. I mean, I could have done multiple things back in the 80s, and I chose language as a, you know, it's kind of interesting. And then I spent my whole life doing it after that. And I'm like, it's been 40 years and I haven't done anything else pretty much as studying language since then, because it was a neat problem. And so anyway.
That's incredible. And yeah, it seems like even though it's just language, it's taken you all over. I thought it'd be really cool to maybe talk about some of the really fascinating work you've done with like the Piraha and the Chimane in Bolivia. Yeah. Can you talk a little bit about how you got there and, some of the work that you've done there?
So, initially, for many, many years, I just studied the structure of industrialized culture languages like English or Russian or Japanese or Chinese, Mandarin or something like that. All these sort of languages where you can get access to data relatively easily. But if you really want to know about human language, it seems important to look at different other kinds of cultures. Then, like, it's true, there's a lot of difference even in those cultures that I've mentioned. So between sort of the Russian versus different East Asian cultures and North American, there's lots of big differences in how people live in certain ways and their cultures in there. But there's bigger differences, and those are, hunter-gatherers is how humans started, and that's like a very different culture. Like sure, Chinese culture is different from North American, but we all have cell phones. We all do kind of the same thing every day, actually, when you compare it to something that a hunter-gatherer does. And so then I wanted to explore how hunter-gatherers, what their language looked like. And I happened to have a collaborator, a guy who was on my thesis committee back when I did my PhD. I went to Carnegie Mellon in was in Pittsburgh, and he was at the University of Pittsburgh. This guy was Dan Everett, and he had just written a paper in the, boy, what year is this? 2005. It was a while ago, and it was about how this particular language. He'd worked on a lot of very remote groups. In fact, he'd started as a missionary. Very interesting guy, Dan Everett, and he lived with the Pirahã, which is a hunter-gatherer group in Amazonia, but just happens to be in the Brazilian part of Amazon, which is most of Amazonia. It's an isolate language. There's a lot of isolate languages in Amazonia, and that's because the geography is such that it's been the same for thousands and thousands of years, unchanged by weather. So basically, you don't get tornadoes, you don't get earthquakes. It's very, very static, and people can live there for thousands and thousands of years and not move. And there's lots of food. And so they have it's fascinating. You have these thousands, hundreds of different languages in the Amazonian rainforest, and Piranha is just one of them. It's a small group of a few hundred. And Dan worked with them for years as a missionary, trying to convert them, to Christianity, as missionaries do. And he turned out, he didn't know when he started, that he was a really gifted natural linguist. That is, a person who can learn a language from other people. He's a very, very social person, Dan is, very social. And so he loves to talk to people. They love to talk to him. He's a very entertaining, very interesting person. And he learned this language really, really well. He never converted anyone, if in case you were interested in the Christianity part of it. He actually gave, he says the story that he gave up Christianity from working with the Pirahã, who were very interested in, him and his as a person, but not much in his culture, in his in either the Christianity. They liked the stories, but they weren't converted. They weren't interested in converting. And so he knew this language very, very well. And he said that they had very different grammar in some ways than industrialized culture languages. And so he invited me down, and I went down to work with him on for just a few weeks back in 2007. And there we were interested in, like, one of there's like, I can't go in a few weeks and learn details of, like, it takes years and years to learn enough about a language to be able to do a decent lexicon, just the words, so you have like maybe a few thousand of the words. And Dan had a decent lexicon of, I mean, he'd there for 30 years. So he actually had a decent lexicon. Building a grammar is even harder. You really need a lot of close work. It really helps to have bilinguals who can tell you how you say these various things in other languages. There's no bilinguals in this language. Dan was it. Dan's gonna learn from nothing from them. And so it's very hard to do. And so he never really wrote a full grammar, he wrote part of it. Anyway, and we were just I'm trying to understand details of the words. Okay. It's like where do languages come from is a really interesting thing. And one of the like the sort of naive view is that we create a language in order to talk to each other, which seems like so it's about communication. It's about when we're taught when we maybe humans create labels for things that they want to talk about. And so the Pirahã were an interesting case in this. Dan said that they didn't have any words for numbers whatsoever, for number words. And this number seems like in our culture, it just seems like such a, they seem like such a fundamentally useful thing to want to label. Words like just 1, 2, 3, 4,
Right.
six, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And his claim was they didn't have any words for numbers at all, like none. And so, but he didn't have any way to, he didn't actually test that. He just sort of said that. And someone else went down there along with him around the same time, a little bit earlier before us. And they, this guy didn't really know how to do experimental stuff too well. And so he sort of messed up the experiments, I would say. And so we did some similar experiments to the guy that went before us. This guy was named Peter Gordon. And we observed, first of all, we found out that they really don't have any numbers, words for numbers whatsoever. And the way we did this is we gave them, it's actually spools of thread. I had, it doesn't really matter what it is. For when I work with the Chimani, I mentioned the Chimani is another tribe, you know, not too far actually from the Pinohan. We work with colored beads then. So I had like black beads, which were kind of big beads about this big. And we could just count those. They're either you can manipulate them easily with your hands, and you can just put them down one at a time and count them. Okay. And so, but I had these spools of thread. I don't know why I had them. They were about this, you know, about like easy holding your hand. They're all identical. And then I would put down one spool of thread and say, "What do you call this?" With Dan was helping me, you know, just please tell me what this is. And they would say what it is. I give it one person, and then I put another one down and say, "What do you call this?" And another one, and so all the way up to, well, actually, so. And this way, by giving them the same object over and over again, see bunches of them, we get labels for not only the object, which they say over and over again to us, but the labels for how they talk about the sets, these abstract properties of the sets, the numeracy of the set. And they only had three words for which they used to describe the numeracies of these sets. There was what people had thought were words for one, about two, and many. And so they used the first word, which we thought was one initially, and then they'd use, you know, when there was two down there, they'd sometimes still use the first word, but you often use the second word. So there was about two. And then they'd switch to the many at about three or four. And they'd switch and they'd say many, many, many. And there it was a little weird in that I would put, so what, say the guy had just said four, I put down four of these and he said, "This is many threads." And then I put down five and say, "What's this?" And he'd say, "Many threads." And then I put down six and I'd say, "What's this?" He'd say, look at me like I wasn't very bright and say many threads. And then we, I'm sorry, I'd sort of apologize and we'd go all the way up to 10 because I wanted to, you know, make sure we have, there's no missing data points here. And so they would think I was a little slow at understanding how to label these sets. And then we'd find that there really were across about 10 people that we had labeled these. They all always used the same word for the head, for the threads, and then only three labels, which were we thought about one, about two, and many. But then we did the same task with the same people counting down. Instead of starting 1, 2, 3, 4 up to 10, we counted down 10, 9, 8, 7, 6. And there we got a very different pattern. The same person counting down from 10 would still would say many, many, many. But then at around 7, they'd start to use the word that we thought was two. And then by four, they would use the word we thought was one. And they all did this. And so they like a given person would just completely shift how they described exactly the same set, depending on the context in which that set had been appeared in. So if that had been it come after a very small sets, then they say this thing is, you know, I don't know what we thought was, you know, two, but it's probably just some. We think that the words are probably, like almost certainly are few and many, and the middle one is just some. And there's just no exact labels for sets whatsoever, for label for numeracies of sets. And that was really, I mean, that was actually really striking to us. And then we did some other experiments to see whether they could deal with exact numeracies without having words for them. And so we would like put out a sequence of five of these spools of thread, and I've given them a different set of objects, and these were uninflated red balloons. It doesn't really matter again what they are, but they're easily manipulable and they don't move around. And then they would just, their task was just put one of your objects against each one of each of mine. That's your task. And when the things were on the table in front of them, they could do it perfectly, which is unsurprising because that's not a counting task. It's like I'm pretty sure I can get my dog to do this task. And so I mean, would you, I mean, I don't know if I can get my dog to do it. That's maybe an exaggeration. It kind of depends how far apart the objects are, but they can learn. There's a one-to-one correspondence. A monkey can do this. Okay, so you can put one against each, and you don't need to know how many there are to be able to see that there's one against each, right? And so they can do this task. They do it perfectly. So they understand what the goal is. But then if we put out that same set of five and then hide the set of the spools of thread and then say, do that. How do we do this task? How do I do this? The way you would do it, the way I would do it, is you count how many there are, remember the number, and put that number down, right? So it's still easy to do if it's three, even if you don't remember the number, because three is sort of very small number, and it's easy to sort of see without ever counting. And so up to about four, people can just see how big the number is without even bothering to count. But when they at five, it seems like maybe you could do it. But nine is hard. Like it's really hard to tell the difference between having 9 or 10. Like nine and 10 look the same. Those sets look the same to humans, and so they would get approximately right. Above four, they would get sometimes more, sometimes less, but approximately right, and many, many wrong. Like so at 10. They would be wrong, 90% of the time, because you'd be, somewhere between 8 and 12, maybe 80% of the time. They're wrong a lot of the time. The same, of course, I run the same task on any numerate culture, and of course we can do these tasks perfectly well. And so so that's like just shows they well, it just it was a demonstration of the sort of usefulness of these labels. These labels are obviously useful for us. This is a very simple task to show they're useful. Like obviously numbers are useful for us, but this is like a way to sort of quantify that in a way. And they can't do it. They can't do that very simple task. And they wanted to be, so some of these participants really, you could tell they wanted to get it right. And so I would look behind the I had an opaque sheet there, and they would want to know whether they got it right or not. And because if I ran this on MIT undergrads, which we did at some point, they know they get it right. I mean, it's like, if you put down 7 and 7, they don't really, obviously it's correct. But these guys didn't know because they have no way to keep track of that exact number set. And so they would want to see if they actually got it right. And they and sometimes did and sometimes didn't, because it's hard.
Oh man, that's so fascinating. This really is bringing up so much. And like a couple of things that I wanted to talk about with you, because as a therapist, we just like think about language, but we don't think about all these edge cases of language. And I think a lot of both parents and therapists I've heard, they sort of kind of feel that, especially parents, it's like language is just supposed to emerge. It's like, teeth or hair, it's just supposed to come out, like, why is my child not learning numbers? They can't do numbers. But I feel like this really suggests that your experience, and the cultural relevance, in specific activities really matters for language acquisition. Is this something that you might agree with, or?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, I mean, my view is that I sort of raised this naive view of what language is, that there's multiple views of what language might be in some way, and what it's for, and why we have it in our cognitive usage in our minds and brains. And the naive view is it's for communication. So it's like it's not for thinking. It might, but there's another view, which is it is for thinking. There is like the philosophical view due to a whole bunch of people going back to Plato, and most famously recently by Noam Chomsky, is that maybe the reason we have language is to do complex thought. Is like the reason language is kind of a reflection of thinking is this idea from, I mean, Chomsky's made it sort of most prominent. He's pushed that idea. But I think this is just, these are ideas that, going back to Plato and Aristotle, they think about whether that's true or not, but they have no way to test them. They just think about it. And same with Chomsky, he's thinking about it, but he's not testing. And he thinks that it's most likely this way. But it turns out to be, probably wrong. And so and the way you can test this is you could, though, so what we think, what I think, it's not based on this research alone, but I think more about the brain research actually, is that when you figure out what you can scan people's brains while they're doing different tasks, for instance, understanding language, and you can figure out where in the brain the is the that task is being operationalized, how that's working in the brain. So it turns out that understanding a language that you understand, since we're talking English here, if we're reading English or listening to English, then there is a network, it turns out, in your mind, in my mind, that understands languages we understand. That's the language network. So it turns out, I mean, unsurprising, there's some network which processes language. That's not That has to be the case because I produce language, you understand language. There has to be something in my brain that's doing it. The interesting feature of this network is that it does language and nothing else. So we can actually, this is a work by Evelina Fedorenko, who's a neuroscientist also at MIT, MMIT.
You
And
should also be on this podcast
is
in
she?
2 weeks.
Okay, well, she,
Yeah.
conflict of interest, I'm married to her, so I know her work very, very well.
Yeah.
Anyway, so, but she
Disclosure.
figured out a long time ago that the ways to answer this question. And so the about what the networks that process language, what, do they do just language or do other things? That her naive opinion going in was that it's very likely that there's overlap. That it's going to be the whatever the neurons, the big system of neurons that's a processing language are probably doing other things as well. And the basis for that hypothesis was that in brain imaging studies, up until her lab's work, there looked to be lots of overlap in where in the brain, say, numerical processing was happening. It looked like the same similar areas as where language processing was happening. And some working memory process, all things, they're, whatever things are easy or difficult, it looked like there was parts of, certainly language is generally left lateralized, so it's mostly going on the left. There's often a right lateral, a right section as well, but overwhelmed for most people, 90, 95% of people, most of the network will be in your left hemisphere. And some of that looked to be in the same places as parts where you do other complex thought, such as spatial working memory, other kinds of working memory, numerical processing, all kinds of tasks. And so she thought likely that network is doing the same thing. But there was a problem with all that previous literature was that they didn't localize each of these networks independently in each person before doing the tests. They would just do broadly across people. So across people, like basically where you find these, this language network, and you'll find there's something, left frontal, and you'll find something in the temporal lobe as well. So there's a left frontal temporal, there's a network there. And you'll often find stuff in bilaterally in the front for any complex task. And it looks like the same. People talk about Broca's area, for example. I hate using the term Broca's area because it means something to a lot of people and it shouldn't. It's I mean, there are meaningful ways to talk about that area. Anyway, so this is a famous doctor from 150 years ago whose name was Paul Broca, who had a patient who had a stroke, and the stroke and that patient couldn't talk very well after he had a stroke. He could still do a lot, but he couldn't speak very well, and he just said a single syllable over and over again. He would say ton ton instead of he couldn't say anything else. And so that aphasia, that brain damage, was associated with is called was often called Broca's aphasia because of that first patient. And he had a very localized left frontal, in posthumous surgery, found where in the brain things were bad for this patient. And it turned to be very focal, a very focal left frontal area, and which ends up being called Broca's area. But that's that particular stroke that this guy had is probably associated with a detailed part of language production, actually, not the language network. So this language network is because this patient could understand everything that the doctor was saying to him. So this was something about there's like
Like motor speech
it's a
production.
motor speech. It's a motor speech area. It's a very narrow motor speech area is where this left frontal bit is. There's a lot of the brain's. It's a lot of stuff, a lot of real estate in there. And
Yeah.
so I worry about this term Broca's area, Broca's thing. And anyway, so the problem with this previous research is well, it looked like there's a lot of stuff going on in the left frontal, maybe left temporal as well, and maybe a bunch of different functions going on there. But if you look at any individual, instead of doing these group stuff, you look at sort of where my language network is, and then you see where my numerical processing is, or where my spatial working memory is, or music processing, just any other task. It turned out in every individual, in every single one, there is no overlap with the language network.
Yeah.
If there's no language
Crazy.
spoken, like actual under, if I can't understand and produce that language, then there is zero overlap. It's like a stunning non-overlap across, she's run now, Fedorenko's lab has run like 30 tasks or so that people have said each one they think there's going to be some overlap, and there's never any overlap. And so this sort of points very strongly to the idea that this what language is this language network, not the speech production bit, which is another part of languages. It's like this is talking about like the compositional bits of putting together words is more abstractly than the particular sounds or the particular, not that part, but the higher level language, putting that together, even though it's a big complicated part of being human, is completely not overlapping with anything else, which is pretty fascinating, and so
Well, that's so mind-blowing. Someone I just spoke to recently, I just wanted to bring this up because it's like flashing light bulbs in my head. And so there's someone, Dr. Elon Barinholtz, who is kind of talking about LLMs and how the fact that LLMs are not, grounding symbols in real-world experience kind of suggests that really what we're, and because they do such an amazing job at form, it kind of suggests that language, like this network, is really, it's not what we think it is. It's not like, it's not the same thing as thinking, kind of like you're saying. It's this separate modular system that the meaning of which is mostly in the kind of high dimensional relationships, like amongst the words. Like a lot of the sort of thing that we think is meaning coming out of language is actually separate from, what we consider to be these grounded, like, oh, my idea of an apple is like this object of an apple. It's like mostly we're not doing that because, and it seems like this fMRI research is sort of saying the same thing that, most of the time this language network is running independently of sensory processing.
She has her group has a paper about this actually, like saying like that exact basic idea that you're getting there is that maybe the reason so language large language models LLMs are so successful, and but what they're best at, all the early versions the LLMs have been best at, is language, is generating perfect English, for example, really pretty much perfect English. Getting the meaning right has turned out to be very hard. So they're really bad. I mean, they're getting better. Because there's a lot of money being put into trying to get them to learn all kinds of concepts, all kinds of, like, for instance, just doing arithmetic, doing math in a large language model is not good. It's still not good. Which is so trivial on your calculator, right? But that's a different system. That's not a large language model doing that. And so getting it to do very simple arithmetic tasks it turns out to be very complicated. And it suggests so that what they think is actually what maybe these large language models are doing language the way humans are doing it in a similar way. And that's just about the form. So they're able to generate very good form-based language, and which is what humans can do too, kind of separate the communication, the actual thinking from the communication system, which is language.
Just like it in the Pirahá, like you were mentioning, that they can actually do these tasks for, at least the 1-to-3, 1-to-1 correspondence tasks. They're doing that, ostensibly non-linguistically, right?
So they can do the task perfectly as long as there's no memory requirement. And so like, that meaning like, so if even if there's 20, or I don't never did 20, but if there are 10 objects, just putting one against one, no problem. That's not an issue. The problem is keeping track of that set independent of looking at it. And so what we do is we make a label for that. Yeah, we have a label. They just don't have that label. They can learn a label. They just don't have it. I mean, what this suggests to me is that this is one of the examples that suggests to me that human language is a communication system, and that what humans do is invent labels for things we want to talk about, which is like something we don't normally, as humans, think about. You sort of think words are somehow defined in a dictionary, would you? And we learn through a dictionary, and this is not how words are invented, or I mean, that's not like how they come to be and how they. And how their meanings come. I mean, actually, numbers are kind of one of the only cases where there are definitions for what these things, mean. And this culture doesn't have any use for those, that particular use, but most words, actually, when you try to think of why do we have any word, I would say that my guess is why we have words is we invent them because we want to tell someone else something, not because we need to think about it, but because we want to talk to someone else about something that we want from them, or we want to tell them about something. And so like colors is another really interesting space which I've investigated a lot. That's perceptual color space. Like there's we can see millions of different, if you have normal vision, normal color vision, you can see, distinguish millions of different colors. We only label a few, and we label quite a few in an industrialized culture like ours. We'll label, 11 that everyone knows in English, and maybe, 20 or 30 more. So what I mean by, everyone knows black, white, red, green, and so on. But you may know words like, aquamarine and taupe. There's like low frequency words which mean some color, and different people know different sets of those. It's still only 50, 20 or 30 or 50 more. We can see millions. So it's still, it's a tiny subset of what we can see. So what are these labels for? Why are we inventing them? Right? I mean, they're coming from something. And plausibly it's because when we have multiple things which are identical in color, sorry, identical except for color, then we need to tell another person which one it is we want them to get as opposed to the other. And so then I need labels. I mean, I guess that's like if you go to like Home Depot or one of these paint stores where they have, I don't know, a few hundred or a few, maybe a few couple
Yeah,
thousand, a few thousand
it's
of different
overwhelming.
colors. And there's numbers with those, right? And then there's labels, but the labels are like no one knows those. I don't think anyone knows those labels. I think they are useful somewhere so that humans can, like, when you get down to the three or four that you're interested in, you can still refer to them, and the number isn't that useful. You don't want 10378 as the way. I still would rather call it burnt orange or something or whatever
Yeah,
it is than some number which means nothing to me. But I can't remember that huge set, right? I don't think, I don't know, maybe someone has some use to know all those. But anyway, that's what we think the labels are there for, is just to talk about objects, that to pull one object out of a set in a way. It's a kind of really interesting question.
I think this is such a important reframe for the way that language was taught in the past, and even till now, like a lot of there's a lot of decontextualized flashcard, like sort of that dictionary definition sort of thing that was going on, where it's like, okay, you learn this set of words, and like there's no activity or a central component attached to that, where it's like the child needs to do something or wants to do something or is engaged in some experiential activity. It's just like this set of words, and then when you test them, it's like the when they know the word is when they could spit that definition back to you. But like that's really a flawed way of thinking about it, especially
That's
if you
right.
yeah if you, especially if these you have the Pidaha who doesn't they don't even have number words, because that's not relevant to their daily life. So I think really making activities for therapists, like really making activities that make these concepts important
I think that's
are the
right.
way to learn.
I mean, like, words usually have different contextual meanings. Like, even if you think of color words, people think that numbers are the kind of the exception. Numbers are the exception, where the meaning of one is independent of anything else. Like, what does one mean? What does two mean? What does three mean? I can actually define those meanings in terms of this abstract sets, quantities. But most words aren't like that. Almost, they're like the exception. They're the only words that are like that. Pretty much numbers. Some quantity numbers are like every and all are like that as well. Like these have labels which have meanings which really I can define. But most words don't. So the word like you think a color is a word which has a label which has a meaning, and it really doesn't. I mean, so what I mean by that is the word red. People think, oh, red means, a particular shade or something. It's like, red wine is a very different shade than red sand. So you're talking about red sand you see in the beach. It's not red like on a red card, right? When you get like a red cup, one of those, beer cups that come in like blue or red or
Beer,
yellow.
yeah.
Those are very same. You've got a red guitar behind you. That's very red, right? That's not the same color as red wine or red sand or red hair. I mean, so what the word means is it depends on what the context is. So it's more a red hair is more red than anything else. Like it's more it's so it's a, we like to use the word red for some reason. We want to label things red even though they're not red. I mean, if it's more red than other, like they're closer to red in this realm of sand, it's mostly very brown, and this is more red. It's towards that, that end. It's very context dependent, right? These labels, and that's how That's normally how words are, right? That's nor that so the colors are just that's typical. Numbers don't have this feature. Like I can't say, no matter what I say to something, it's always to exactly to, and there's no other, like there is no way, it isn't context dependent there. But other words are almost all context dependent. And so, which is kind of interesting.
So teach in context, folks. Also, you've mentioned a lot of Japanese examples. I noticed in some of your talks. I don't know if you speak it, but in the lights, the green light in Japan, they call it a blue light, which is I always just thought it's so interesting because that it's
I didn't know
definitely
that.
looks the exact same. It was just so strange to me when I learned that. Anyway,
No, I didn't
yeah.
know that. I didn't know that. I actually don't speak Japanese. The reason I like Japanese and examples is mostly because of the word order. The
It's
order of the words in English is very, very different from in, I mean, Japanese is a nice salient language where the word order is very different. And so I like that for that purposes mostly.
maybe we can shift gears, and I think that might be a good transition to talk a little bit about dependency grammar. SLPs aren't really linguists, but I think syntax is relevant to us is for language habilitation, and I think there are definitely a lot of misconceptions around syntax, and it was just so amazingly interesting to learn about some of these, I guess universals that you've discovered about language, not really in the Chomskyan way, but universals in the sense that there are these kind of cognitive constraints that lead us to construct languages in a particular way. Can you talk a little bit about your framework or why you think this is the best framing for?
So this is one of the things I've been working on for a really long time, and there's a it turns out there's a, I think a pretty simple solution to this problem of what is the syntax of a human language. People think, I mean, going back to Chomsky actually proposed, if people are interested, that language is unlearnable. He talks about, actually he's sort of partially responsible for this nativist, this innate thing, I mean, very largely responsible. He's very, very good, very influential, right? He's very, really powerful speaker. He convinced a lot of people that language is innate, and I think his arguments are all wrong. So he, going back to Chomsky, he proposed very, no, he did a lot of really great work. So back in 1957, he wrote this lovely book called Syntactic Structures, where he worked out a sort of a formalization of how to work out what the structure of a language is. Everyone, I mean, even then and before, we know that there's some kind of list of words, okay? And it's big. There's a big list of words in the dictionary. And so we can do that across, we can list, and you get a lexicographer or someone to write down roughly what these things mean. Where the definitions come from is a is an interesting question, and I think they're culturally defined mostly, but people can do this. And so we can write down in English, we can write down for an adult literate speaker who reads, you'll know something on the order, many thousands, 10 to 50, sort of 50,000 different words. And it kind of depends what you def how we define word and stuff. But it's some large number that, basically Oxford Learner's Dictionaries or Merriam-Webster or something. These things have lists of these lists, and we can do this. We can do this in any language. You can write down the things that get used over and over again, and maybe we can write down definitions. And the puzzle has been, how do we form more complex units? Obviously, we're not going to put down all the sentences that people say because there's an unbounded number. It's easy to write a sentence or say a sentence that no one's ever said before. It's just very, very easy. We have 50,000 words, and you put them together in some organization, and it's easy to get beyond the number of particles in the universe. So it's like, it doesn't matter if it's finite or infinite. I mean, because people talk about this infinity thing, it doesn't matter. It's like, if it's finite, it's so large as to be beyond anyone's conception. And so I don't care about infinity or not. I just care it's very big, ridiculously large numbers of things. And so we have to store, we're storing the words somehow. And what are the, how are we putting these things together? What is the syntax? And Chomsky proposed that there was rules, which is fine for like putting two words together to make something bigger. Like a noun phrase is a determiner, and a noun, like a word like, a dog is plus dog, and that's a noun phrase or something. And then maybe there's, other rules like that. And he also guessed not only there are these rules to put the words together, which is, I think he's right about that part. And that's what I would call the dependency rules in a language. So any in any sentence, you can figure out the dependency structure So I just said, here's a simple sentence. You know, I have this dog who keeps coming into the room. So the dog entered the room. So there's the dog, and so the depends on dog, and dog depends on enters, and the room, the depends on room, and I guess room depends back on enters as well. So at the whole root of that is an entering event, and dog is like doing is the agent of that, and the patient of the entering, I guess, is the room. And so it doesn't matter what the labels are there, but I can just sort of draw these links between those words, and that, and I think Chomsky would have agreed with that pretty much. Anyway, I'm sort of doing two things at once here. So one is I'm saying what I think is right, and another thing is what I think is wrong. Chomsky also thought there was like some transformational rules, and maybe I don't need to talk about those. And he thought that not only do you have these putting things together, but you can also move things around. And that moving things around part turns out to make language very, very hard to learn. He didn't quite understand that. He just because he thought it's obviously true that there are these transformational rules, but I think there just aren't any transformational rules.
This
And
is
if
like
there are
verb movement.
movement
This is like
rules,
verb movement. Yeah, okay. Got it.
exactly. Verb
Yeah.
movement, any kind of movement, any kind of things where move around, where, you know, he thought it was obvious. And so you didn't have to prove this or demonstrate this. But I think it's not obvious at all that there are any movement rules. And so, and if there aren't movement rules, the problem with movement rules is he's right. It makes it very hard to figure out what the form of the grammar is that the kid is trying to learn because it's not just the sequence. So you can imagine learning the words. It's like you hear the word in a context, you hear someone say it, and you can pick up what that sequence of sounds is you're supposed to say with that, you know, doggy thing. You know, I hear doggy, doggy, doggy enough, and I figure out that doggy refers to that, and I can figure out what doggy is. And so we can learn words in this way. And you know, the syntax is similarly simple, actually, if it's just the links, if it's just figuring out the, oh, I hear the, I say the's a hard word to learn actually in English, but because it's a weird, it means something strange, right? But anyway, but we can learn that it always comes before the noun and it's dependent on that noun. And we can learn that we hear it all the time. So we can figure, we might have a hard time figuring out what it means because it's about a contextually dependent, relevant thing, but we can learn that word. And so those things are kind of not too hard to learn because we hear them all the time and the order. And so we can figure that out. And similarly with, you know, the orders of verbs relative to their nouns and so on, we can learn these things from hearing them. The hard part for Chomsky's rule system is that these things can move around. So I not only have to learn where they connect, I have to learn where they might have come from. And they might have come, so if they can come from anywhere, which they can under his system, then it's a very hard learning problem. It's very hard to figure out that system. And so that's why I just think this is wrong, that system. And a simpler system is to say, well, maybe there's just multiple copies of similar things, as opposed to saying these things move. And so he thought it was obvious there was movement. Because when I say the dog will enter the room, that was clearly related to a question like, will the dog enter the room? Where there's two different orders. One's a statement, I'm telling you, the dog will enter the room. Another one's a question, will the dog enter the room? And they mean the same thing, sort of, will here. These two wills, but they're in different positions. And he thinks they are the same word and one's moved from one to the other. And that's hard to learn. The alternative is there's just kind of two different versions of this word. One will is I say it in declarative sentences, and one I use it in questions. And he, I think, implicitly just didn't like that idea. But that's easy to learn. That's an easy thing to learn. Like I can just learn, you know, how do I use a question and how do I use a sentence, a declarative.
Yeah.
They're different situations, right? They're very different situations when I want something
Right.
from you versus when I'm telling you something. It's not hard to learn those. It isn't. And so
Yeah.
anyway, this is why the transformational approach is hard. The non-transformational approach doesn't have this learning problem. And then it also has a lot of advantages. We're talking about this cross-linguistic, why languages look the way they do. So it turns out that if we just have this, what you see is what you get for flavor. So it's what I'm learning is just the words and how they connect to one another. It turns out that English has a particular word order. And so I say, you know, that it was like the dog enters the room. So we have the things, there's something that comes first. We'll call it a subject, right? So it has a lot of different roles, meaning roles in English. And then there's a verb, and then everything else comes afterwards, typically. And so I can say things like, the dog ate the pizza. I can say the dog chased the bone, or dog chased the cat. So the dog is always coming first. There's a lot of dogs doing a lot of different things, and all these other things are coming afterwards. And or I can I, the verb can be much more complicated, so it can have more interesting arguments, more interesting thing to say. I can say, I told. I told my daughter a story. I told my daughter that she should be home on time. So those are two different argument structures for telling, the verb tell, and all these things come after in English. Okay, and other languages order things differently a little bit. So English orders them one way, which is subject, then verbs, then objects. All these things count as objects. And I mentioned Japanese is an example, lovely example of a language which is just very verb final. So it's subject, object, verb. So the subject still is first, but now all the things that typically came after the verb now come before the verb. And those are the most two common word orders, the two most common word orders across the world's languages. There's English, which is actually like, Italian and French and German and Chinese and tons of many, many, thousands of other languages actually. And SOV, subject, object, verb, like Japanese, is like another many thousand languages. Actually, this is maybe a few more, maybe sort of 45% or SOV, and 40% or so are SVO. And then there's like a 10% of something else and some others which are we're kind of unsure about. But most of the languages of the world are either SOV or SVO, English and Chinese on one side, and Japanese and Korean and Hindi on the other. So those are SOV languages. And when they're SOV or SVO, they have this sort of bunch of properties that tend to go together, which has been it's been well known, but not well understood until I mean we I can't say I understand it, but we have a very good story for it. So this story that I'm going to tell you, the problem is it's hard to prove this story, but it's a nice story. The story I'm telling you is just about how easy it is to produce language, okay? Produce and understand language. And so when you have these like very simple dependency grammar trees, when you just have these links between the words that connect to form a meaning, it turns out that it's easier to produce and understand them when those links are short. When the words that depend on each other are right beside each other, it's very easy for me to say those things, and it's very easy for you to understand them. So it's good when things are close. If you have an SVO language like English, then it turns out to be better, more easy for you to produce sentences if you also have these things called prepositions. So there's like these markers of words, of nouns, basically, like of and to and by so I gave a book to Mary. I went to the park with Mary. So with, and I bought a picture of Mary. So all this word of and with and by, these are all prepositions. And these words come before they're nouns in English, just like it's sort of verb first in a way. These are head first prepositions, just like verbs come before their arguments. Turns out that goes very well. So if it's verb first, like English, SVO, verbs before objects, then almost always you have prepositions. And then you go to a language like Japanese or Hindi or Korean, these languages are all verb final. They are all so-called postpositions. So every one of the translation of these words always comes after the noun now instead of before. And so, why is this? It turns out if you draw the trees, and if you did the opposite, if you made a language which was verb first and then postposition.
Postposition.
Postposition, if you do that, which is really rare in the world, you end up with long connections between words. You end up having these verb goes to the postposition, which then comes back to the noun, which ends up being at the links may end up being much longer than if you did the verb to the preposition to the noun. And same with the opposite. For you often for language like Japanese, you don't have prepositions there. And it's because I say because I don't know this again. We're speculating. It's a very nice story about like first of it's I can tell you for sure that in language processing, when people produce and understand language, it is easier to produce and understand local connections and produce them. It's much easier. So we can give you lots of evidence of that in either reaction time, or in what ratings, what you rate about these things, or even brain, how activated your brain is in the language network for those longer distance versus local connections. There's more activity when there are longer connections, and so there's lots of dependent measures which make it easier to connect close things. And then I can, it's just plausible that, I mean, the problem is I can't find out how languages are created. Like, that's like what we got is like a bunch of examples of human languages. There's like 7,000 right now on Earth right now. And we can look at each one of them, but watching how a language is created is not something we can generally do. We just don't have access to that. What we have is like current states of where they are. We don't know why they are the way they are. We just have, and we can make stories about this. And I think it's plausible that it's because of minimizing dependencies, but we can't say that's for sure. And, but anyway, that's a kind of a story there. Anyway.
Can you give a quick example just so maybe we can all get an idea of like what's a sentence? You gave a couple of funny ones in your talk, I remember, but like what's one that has like really local connections is simple, and then one that has like more long distance connections or something that might make it more difficult to disambiguate with a
Yeah, well, I
longer
can tell you,
connection?
I don't know what the examples that you're probably thinking of. There's like ambiguity examples where it's like kind of funny local, where people notice the local connections. And there's like, I mean, the examples I do, I don't know, they're very funny. They are. I typically talk about something called nested structures, nested versus non-nested structures. And so a nested structure is one that always has long distance connections. And so in English, I can say, I said this dog here, the dog entered the room, and I can say the dog, I can modify the dog now. I can say the dog which the girl likes entered the room. And that's a fine English sentence, right? That's okay. But in principle, it should be possible to modify the girl. The dog which the girl likes entered the room. It should be possible. Like, I could talk about the girl, the girl who did something, I don't know, who my wife loves, okay? So the now if I the girl who my wife loves is a perfectly good clause modifying a noun. It's fine. But it's weird to put in there. So if I say now the dog which the girl who my wife loves likes enters the room, that's not something people can produce or understand. I mean, I could do it by just wrote memorizing that thing there. It's just not pop. And so what I've done there is made very long distance connections. I keep separating a noun which needs to find its verb. It's going to connect to that verb, and I kept adding more things there, and there's more and more of these links. Now, if I could have the exact same meaning, I could say my wife loves the girl who likes the dog which entered the room. It's exactly the same meaning. All local dependencies, no problem producing or understanding it. So, and we can do that in any language, actually. If I nest things in any language, it doesn't, the word order for English is a particular word order. I can do different structures in Japanese when I nest them. But if I nest them like that, it turns into nonsense just like English does. In any language you do that, you'll get nested structures with these long distance connections are awful. They're unprocessable. I don't know if those are funny. Any of the funny examples you were thinking of, you were probably thinking of some other
Like
more.
the something about the squirrel that was hit by the mayor or something like that, but that's
Oh, that's
okay.
like
Yeah. No.
that's like a newspaper headline. That was a newspaper headline you're thinking of, which is a real newspaper headline. It was I can't remember what it is though. Another one was the rumors about NBA referees getting ugly. This is one of those examples where it's the rumors that are supposed. That was a real headline from the 80s, a long time ago when I was, the rumors are getting ugly. But there's a tendency to process, when you say about NBA referees getting ugly, it's like there's a tendency to connect to the most local thing, which is the referees there. And
Referees,
so
yeah.
the rumor would be about them getting ugly as opposed to the rumors that are actually intent. Now, I mean, probably the whoever wrote that headline intended the joke, right? They knew, but it's hard not to read it that way. It's hard not to read it that way. And so, yeah.
Right.
So there's in ambiguity, there's a strong local bias that you like to, so I guess maybe that's what you're thinking of is these, there's whenever you read something or listen to something, there's a tendency to want to take a word to the to more local connection if possible. And sometimes that's funny, and we notice that.
You know, I was thinking about these like long distance connections, and you know, something that we naturally do. We talk about this in speech therapy a lot, is like, infant-directed speech or mother ease, where we're kind of like, we're almost taking out all the filler words and we're making things as simple as possible for language development's sake. I wonder if you have any ideas about, should we be then thinking about these forms, like speaking in simple sentences, kind of as a scaffolding as the child is getting older? Should we kind of be thinking we should sort of reduce the legalese, like the center embeddings and stuff like that, when they're learning? Or I don't know, because there's this big debate that's going on for a long time. Like, should you just speak like a normal adult to your child, or use more of these simple structures? Do you have an idea or any
I
thoughts
mean,
about
it's a
that?
fascinating question, and I don't know what I think. That's a very difficult, like the problem with the experimental work on that, if you want to do experiment, is it's very hard. It's like really difficult. It's so confounded, right? With so many, how are you going to test this claim? I mean, I mean, it's just really, really, I mean, my guess is it probably is helpful. My guess is it's probably helpful to start simple. And I do think that mother ease is probably useful for infants in learning. I think there's the naive views are often right, I think. And that's a naive view. However, let me just, like, for instance, hunter-gatherers learn their language perfectly well. They have a very different intuition. So I've worked with these two different groups over the years. So the Pirahã and the Chimane, but it's apparently quite common across hunter-gatherer groups to not talk to your babies at all. Okay? They don't do mother ease. They don't talk to their kids. They baby don't talk to their babies. They carry their babies everywhere. So there's a lot of differences about how babies are raised in hunter-gatherer societies. They carried everywhere, so they don't want to be held by foreigners, by us. They want their people to hold them. Their own, and so that's very different from us, right? For our babies, they're always in carriers, child carriers. So babies are fine being in child carriers everywhere. So we can do lots of things with them, like experiments and stuff. But babies are being held by their mothers all the time. It's actually not always their mothers. They have a lot of siblings because a lot of kids. And so a lot of times siblings are holding them. And so they're learning. And but anyways, but they're the parents. You ask the parents, do you know, how do you talk to your baby? They, I don't talk to my babies. And what they say is they don't understand. Why would I talk to them? And so I think it's, which is also naively correct, right? The babies don't really talk. What's the point? They learn perfectly well. And so I mean, I do think it's like, but they're probably learning from their siblings a lot, right? Because they have a lot of siblings. And so
Do
anyway,
they, yeah. Is it the same trajectory? Like what, like around like
we
babbling
don't
and stuff
know.
like
So
that?
that's a very poor, the quantitative data on learning words, learning language in hunter-gatherers is very, there's hardly anything. There's hardly any. But there is, I talked to the parents and they're just like, in both of these cultures, and apparently this is common. I talked to other researchers that they don't think it's useful to talk. It's just, but I mean, it's just interesting, and they seem, but we don't know. Probably there's subtle, maybe even big differences in how fast the kids may learn. We just don't know. That's like a, I mean, and anything that you think is good is probably good, right? I think mostly it's mostly about just contact with your kids, like trying to connect with them in whatever ways you can. That's why, like, reading to them is great, because they just, human contact is wonderful for learning everything, probably. Those are like the naive views, which are probably right, but I don't know. Those are hard things to test.
I think it's so important. Yeah. I mean, just the simple stuff is, just that human contact, human interaction is where so much of this stuff is learned.
The screens, not so much, right? And so so the having the human contact,
Yeah, that's something I've been talking about a lot, and something I hope to study more, is like the effect of kind of, I see a lot of my friends who are parents now. It's like, they give their kids iPads or something to just kind of make them quiet, and it turns out that there's a ton of, both reduced interpersonal interaction, and then there's also this digital noise, which is like something that you don't interact with necessarily, which is like, kind of giving you decontextualized, maybe increasing the noise and the signal to noise ratio, let's say, for as far as language goes. And it seems like there's also this big increase in the incidence of communication disorders as these devices have become more, widespread. So just something that I hope to look at more. But yeah, I appreciate, thank you so much again for coming on and talking to us. Is there anything that you're excited about now or you think that needs to be studied?
Yeah, I mean, I'm always still fascinated by the same questions I've been fascinated about by all this time. And so, like this, I really like syntax, and so I'm still like fascinated by syntax and trying to understand. I don't think that when I'm sort of telling you about this dependency grammar as a way to, I do think it's a very good generalization about kind of what human language is, but I don't think it's the end story at all. I think it's a very interesting question as to what dependencies really are between words. Like, I kind of want to know that. I mean, I could, because I large language models learn this stuff really well. It's part of my motivation for liking dependency grammar is I think they're encoding something like dependency grammar implicitly. And so trying to understand large language models and how they learn language and how similar and different that is from human. I mean, you brought up one way which is very different is that it's decontextualized, right? So there's no, it's just the forms. They're learning very, very well, way more data. They have access to much, much more language than kids have, but they learn it really well, just from the forms without learning. So that's a very interesting question is, what is the role of the contextualized meaning in learning language and what language is? I find that like completely fascinating. And so we're still ways off from understanding that. And so trying to understand the relationship to that and large language models is very important. I don't know if we'll get there, but I mean, sure, we will get somewhere in the next few years.
Well, thank you so much for your work. I mean, all the, the things that I've learned from your talks have really changed how I'm thinking about speech and language, and it's great food for thought. And I think especially the stuff about a good just reminder for all therapists that, like, that thinking is separate from language, and
That's right.
that language is a communication system, for the thinking. And I think that the brain research that you're mentioning, so convincing when you can have, like, all these people who maybe don't have a functioning language system, they can't do language based tasks, but are doing all these other things like chess and,
That's
logic
right. That's right. Yeah, we
and
talk
things
about
like
that.
that.
That's another whole avenue of research is looking at people with brain damage, so they can't produce language, can't understand language, but they can think. Some of these people have so global aphasias, and they can do all kinds of very complex thinking tasks, and yet they can't do language. And so their thought process is not gone. They feel they're depressed. It's tough. Because for exactly the reason you brought up earlier, is like people associate being able to speak well with being smart. And those aren't the same. Those aren't the same things. We've got these great examples of these systems now that write beautifully. GPTs, and they're not smart in a lot of ways. They say they're really missing a lot of thinking, reasoning ability. They're, and yet, and so this is like per beautiful language and no, I mean, I'd say in a lot of cases, very low thinking capacity inside. And so, and the inverse. So you get these people who have no inability to talk and yet they can think. They have lots, but we can't, it's very hard to access, unfortunately. So it's tough, very tough for them as people. Imagine that, not being able to talk to other people. And them just thinking you're stupid, right? Because you can't talk.
Definitely.
Oh, it's tough.
We work with a lot of those. I know for all the therapists here, I'm sure at least one on your caseload, you've known that, they know so much that they can't express. And so it's a good thing to remember that, just because you can't say something doesn't mean you don't understand something. And then I guess on the flip side too, it's like just because you can say something, maybe you could spit out a definition, doesn't mean you understand that. Or, even if you can reason about it linguistically, like an LLM, right? Even if you can reason about something linguistically, it doesn't mean you experientially know what that means. So this is kind of like, these we have to be careful to disentangle language and thinking in this way, I guess.
Exactly right.
Well, thank you so much, Ted. You're definitely you're an inspiration, revealing part of this mystery about language. And any last remarks or conclusions like to leave us with? Any asks of the speech therapy audience?
No, not all of you. You're welcome to contact me if you want. I'm happy to answer emails or it's fine. So,
Beautiful. Ted, thank you so much. And everyone, take care, stay curious, and hope to see you in the next episode.